ॐ नमः भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमः भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमः भगवते वासुदेवाय। This morning we are reading from Srila Prabhupada Leelamrita, biography of his divine grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada by Satsvarupa Das Goswami. Chapter 9, Stay High Forever. But while this was going on, an old man, 1 year past his allotted 70, wandered into New York's East Village and set about to prove to the world that he knew where God could be found. In only 3 months, the man, Swami A.C. Bhaktivedanta, succeeded in convincing the world's toughest audience, bohemians, acid heads, potheads and hippies, that he knew the way to God. Turn off, sing out and fall in. This new brand of holy man, with all due deference to Dr. Leary, has come forth with a brand of consciousness expansion that is sweeter than acid, cheaper than pot, and non-bustable by fuss. How is all this possible? Through Krishna, the Swami says. From the East Village Other, October 1966. It's like a community newspaper. It's a little quotation from the article about the early days of the Hare Krishna movement. Prabhupada's health was good that summer and fall, or so it seemed. He worked long and hard, and except for 4 hours of rest at night, he was always active. He would speak intensively, on and on, never tiring, and his voice was strong. His smiles were strong and charming, his singing voice loud and melodious. During Kirtana, he would thump Bengali mridanga rhythms on his bongo drum, sometimes for an hour. He ate heartily of rice, dal, chapatis and vegetables with ghee. His face was full and his belly protuberant. Sometimes, in a light mood, he would drum with 2 fingers on his belly and say that the resonance affirmed his good health. His golden color had the radiance of youth and well-being preserved by 70 years of healthy, non-destructive habits. When he smiled, virility and vitality came on so strong as to embarrass a faded, dissolute New Yorker. In many ways, he was not at all like an old man, and his new followers completely accepted his active youthfulness as a part of the wonder of Swamiji, just as they had come to accept the wonder of the chanting and the wonder of Krishna. Swamiji wasn't an ordinary man. He was spiritual. He could do anything. None of his followers dared advise him to slow down, nor did it ever really occur to them that he needed such protection. They were busy just trying to keep up with him. During the 2 months at 26 Second Avenue, he had achieved what had formerly been only a dream. He now had a temple, a duly registered society, full freedom to preach, and a band of initiated disciples. When a godbrother had written, asking him how he would manage a temple in New York, Prabhupada had said that he would need men from India, but that he might find an American or two who could help. That had been last winter. Now Krishna had put him in a different situation. He had received no help from his godbrothers, no big donations from Indian business magnates, and no assistance from the Indian government, but he was finding success in a different way. These were happy days, he said. He had struggled alone for a year, but then Krishna sent me men and money. Yes, these were happy days for Prabhupada, but his happiness was not like the happiness of an old man's sunset years as he fades into the dim comforts of retirement. His was the happiness of youth, a time of blossoming, of new powers, a time when future hopes expand without limit. He was 71 years old, but But in ambition, he was a courageous youth. He was like a young giant just beginning to grow. He was happy because his preaching was taking hold. Just as Lord Chaitanya had been happy when he had travelled alone to South India, spreading the chanting of Hare Krishna. Prabhupada's happiness was that of a selfless servant of Krishna, to whom Krishna was sending candidates for devotional life. He was happy to place the seed of devotion within their hearts and to train them in chanting Hare Krishna, hearing about Krishna and working to spread Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada continued to accelerate. After the first initiations and the first marriage, he was eager for the next step. He was pleased by what he had, but he wanted to do more. It was the greed of the Vaishnava, not a greed to have sense gratification, but to take more and more for Krishna. He would go in like a needle and come out like a plow. That is to say, from a small, seemingly insignificant beginning, he would expand his movement to tremendous proportions. At least, that was his desire. He was not content with his newfound success and security at 26 Second Avenue, but he was yearning to increase his con as far as possible. This had always been his vision, and he had written it into the ISKCON Charter to achieve real unity and peace in the world, within the members and humanity at large. Swamiji gathered his group together. He knew that once they tried it, they would love it, but it would only happen if he personally went with them. Washington Square Park was only half a mile away, maybe a little more. Ravindra Swarupa. He never made a secret of what he was doing. He used to say, "I want everybody to know what we are doing." Then one day, D-Day came, he said, "We are going to chant in Washington Square Park." Everybody was scared. You just don't go into a park and chant. It seemed like a weird thing to do. But he assured us, saying, "You won't be afraid when you start chanting. Krishna will help you." And so we trudged down to Washington Square Park, but we were very upset about it. Up until that time, we weren't exposing ourselves. I was upset about it, and I know that several other people were, to be making a public figure of yourself. With Prabhupada leading, they set out on that fair Sunday morning, walking the city blocks from 2nd Avenue to Washington Square in the heart of Greenwich Village. And the way he looked, just by walking, he created a sensation. None of the boys had shaved heads or robes, but because of Swamiji, with his saffron robes, his white pointy shoes, and his shaved head held high, people were astonished. It wasn't like when he would go out alone. That brought nothing more than an occasional second glance. But today, with a group of young men hurrying to keep up with him, as he headed through the city streets, obviously about to do something, he caused a stir. Tough guys and kids called out names, and others laughed and made sounds. A year ago in Butler, the Agarwals had been sure that Prabhupada had not come to America for followers. He didn't want to make any waves, Sally had thought, but now he was making waves. Walking through the New York City streets, headed for the first public chanting in America, followed by his first disciples. In the park, there were hundreds of people milling about, stylish, decadent Greenwich villagers, visitors from other boroughs, tourists from other states and other lands, an amalgam of faces, nationalities, ages and interests. As usual, someone was playing his guitar by the fountain. Boys and girls were sitting together and kissing. Some were throwing frisbees. Some were playing drums or flutes or other instruments. And some were walking their dogs, talking, watching everything, wandering around. It was a typical day in the village. Prabhupada went to a patch of lawn where, despite a small sign that read, "Keep off the grass," many people were lounging. He sat down and one by one his followers sat beside him. He took out his brass hand cymbals and sang the Maha Mantra, and his disciples responded, awkwardly at first, then stronger. It wasn't as bad as they had thought it would be. Jagannath, it was a marvelous thing, a marvelous experience that Swamiji brought upon me, because it opened me up a great deal and I overcame a certain shyness the first time to chant out in the middle of everything. A curious crowd gathered to watch, though no one joined in. Within a few minutes, two policemen moved in through the crowd. "Who is in charge here?" an officer asked roughly. The boys looked toward Prabhupada. "Didn't you see the sign?" an officer asked. Swamiji furrowed his brow and turned his eyes toward the sign. He got up and walked to the uncomfortably warm pavement and sat down again, and his followers straggled after to sit around him. Prabhupada continued the chanting for half an hour, and the crowd stood listening. A guru in America had never gone onto the streets before and sung the names of God. After Ketana, he asked for a copy of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and he had Hayagriva read aloud from the preface. With clear articulation, Hayagriva read, "Disparity in the human society is due to the basic principle of a godless civilization. There is God, the Almighty One, from whom everything emanates, by whom everything is maintained, and in whom everything is made to rest." The crowd was still. Afterward, the Swami and his followers walked back to the storefront, feeling elated and victorious. They had broken the American silence. Allen Ginsberg lived nearby on East 10th Street. One day he received a peculiar invitation in the mail. "Practice the transcendental sound vibration. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. This chanting will cleanse the dust from the mirror of the mind. International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Meetings at 7 a.m. daily. Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays at 7 p.m. You are cordially invited to come and bring your friends." Swamiji had asked the boys to distribute it around the neighborhood. One evening, soon after he received the invitation, Allen Ginsberg and his roommate, Peter Orlowski, arrived at the storefront in a Volkswagen minibus. Allen had been captivated by the Hare Krishna mantra several years before, when he had first encountered it at the Kumbh Mela festival in Allahabad, India, and he had been chanting it often ever since. The devotees were impressed to see the world-famous author of Howl and leading figure of the Beat Generation enter their humble storefront. His education of free sex, marijuana and LSD, his claims of drug-induced visions of spirituality in everyday sights, his political ideas, his exploration of insanity, revolts and nakedness, and his attempts to create a harmony of like-minded souls, all were influential on the minds of American young people, especially those living on the Lower East Side. Although by middle-class standards he was scandalous and disheveled, he was in his own right a figure of worldly repute, more so than anyone who had ever come to the storefront before. Allen Ginsberg, "Bhaktivedanta seemed to have no friends in America, but was alone, totally alone, and gone somewhat like a lone hippie to the nearest refuge, the place where it was cheap enough to rent. There were a few people sitting cross-legged on the floor. I think most of them were Lower East Side hippies who had just wandered in off the street with the beards and a curiosity and inquisitiveness and a respect for a spiritual presentation of some kind. Some of them were sitting there with glazed eyes, but most of them were just like gentlefolk, bearded, hip and curious. They were refugees from the middle class in the Lower East Side, looking exactly like the street sadhus in India. It was very similar, that face in American underground history, and I liked immediately the idea that Swami Bhaktivedanta had chosen the Lower East Side of New York for his practice. He had gone to the lower depths. He had gone to a spot more like the side streets of Calcutta than any other place. Alan and Peter had come for the Kirtana, but it wasn't quite time. Prabhupada hadn't come down. They presented a new harmonium to the devotees. "It is for the Kirtana," said Alan. "A little donation." Alan stood at the entrance to the storefront, talking with Hayagriva, telling him how he had been chanting Hare Krishna around the world, at peace marches, poetry readings, a procession in Prague, a writers' union in Moscow. "Secular Kirtana," said Alan, "but Hare Krishna nonetheless." Then Prabhupada entered. Alan and Peter sat with the congregation and joined in the Kirtana. Alan played harmonium. Alan: "I was astounded that he had come with the chanting, because it seemed like a reinforcement from India. I had been running around singing Hare Krishna, but I had never understood exactly why or what it meant. But I was surprised to see that he had a different melody, because I thought the melody I knew was the melody. The universal melody. I had gotten so used to my melody that actually the biggest difference I had with him was over the tune, because I had solidified it in my mind for years, and to hear another tune actually blew my mind." After the lecture, Alan came forward to meet Prabhupada, who was sitting still on his dais. Alan offered his respects with folded palms and touched Prabhupada's feet, and Prabhupada reciprocated by nodding his head and folding his palms. Jai Shri Gaur Nitai Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Rasvihari Lalita Vishaka Ki Jai. Shri Shri Sitaram Lakshman Bhakta Hanuman Ji Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. They talked together briefly, and then Prabhupada returned to his apartment. Alan mentioned to Hayagriva that he would like to come by again and talk more with Prabhupada. So Hayagriva invited him to come the next day and stay for lunch prasadam. Don't you think Swamiji is a little too esoteric for New York?" Alan asked. Hayagriva thought. "Maybe," he replied. Hayagriva then asked Alan to help the Swami, since his visa would soon expire. He had entered the country with a visa for a 2-month stay, and he had been extending his visa for 2 more months again and again. This had gone on for 1 year, but the last time he had applied for an extension, he had been refused. "We need an immigration lawyer," said Hayagriva. "I will donate to that," Alan assured him. The next morning, Allen Ginsberg came by with a check and another harmonium. Up in Prabhupada's apartment, he demonstrated his melody for chanting Hare Krishna, and then he and Prabhupada talked. Alan: "I was a little shy with him because I didn't know where he was coming from. I had that harmonium I wanted to donate, and I had a little money. I thought it was great now that he was here to expound on the Hare Krishna mantra. That would sort of justify my singing. I knew what I was doing, but I didn't have any theological background to satisfy further inquiries, and here was someone who did. So I thought that was absolutely great. Now I could go around singing Hare Krishna, and if anybody wanted to know what it was, I could just send them to Swami Bhaktivedanta to find out. If anyone wanted to know the technical intricacies and the ultimate history, I could send them to him. He explained to me about his own teacher and about Chaitanya and the lineage going back. His head was filled with so many things and what he was doing. He was already working on his translations. He always seemed to be sitting there just day after day and night after night. And I think he had 1 or 2 people helping him." Prabhupada was very cordial with Alan, quoting a passage from Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says that whatever a great man does, others will follow. He requested Alan to continue chanting Hare Krishna at every opportunity so that others would follow his example. He told about Lord Chaitanya's organizing the first civil disobedience movement in India, leading a Sankirtana protest march against the Muslim ruler. Alan was fascinated. He enjoyed talking with the Swami. But they had their differences. When Alan expressed his admiration for a well-known Bengali holy man, Prabhupada said that the holy man was bogus. Alan was shocked. He had never before heard a Swami severely criticize another's practice. Prabhupada explained on the basis of Vedic evidence the reasoning behind his criticism, and Alan admitted that he had naively thought that all holy men were 100% holy. But now he decided that he should not simply accept a sadhu, including Prabhupada, on blind faith. He decided to see Prabhupada in a more severe critical light. Alan, I had a very superstitious attitude of respect, which probably was an idiot sense of mentality, and so Swami Bhaktivedanta's teaching was very good to make me question that. It also made me question him and not take him for granted. Alan described a divine vision he had, in which William Blake had appeared to him in sound, and in which he had understood the oneness of all things. A sadhu in Vrindavana had told Alan that this man, that William Blake, was his guru. But to Prabhupada, this made no sense. Alan, the main thing, above and beyond all our differences, was an aroma of sweetness that he had, a personal, selfless sweetness, like total devotion. And that was what always conquered me. Whatever intellectual questions or doubts I had, or even cynical views of ego, in his presence, there was a kind of personal charm coming from dedication that conquered all our conflicts. Even though I did not agree with him, I always liked to be with him. Alan agreed at Prabhupada's request to chant more and to try to give up smoking. Do you really intend to make these American boys into Vaishnavas? Alan asked. Yes, Prabhupada replied happily. And I will make them all Brahmanas. Alan left a $200 check to help cover the legal expenses for extending the Swami's visa and wished him good luck. Brahmanas! Alan didn't see how such a transformation could be possible. September 23. It was Radhashtami, the appearance day of Srimati Radharani, Lord Krishna's eternal consort. Prabhupada held his second initiation. Keith became Kirtanananda, Steve became Satsarupa, Bruce became Brahmananda, and Chuck became Achyudananda. It was another festive day with a fire sacrifice in Prabhupada's front room and a big feast. Prabhupada lived amid the drug culture in a neighborhood where the young people were almost desperately attempting to alter their consciousness, whether by drugs or by some other means. Whatever was available, Prabhupada assured them that they could easily achieve the higher consciousness they desired by chanting Hare Krishna. It was inevitable that in explaining Krishna consciousness, he would make allusions to the drug experience, even if only to show that the two were contrary paths. He was familiar already with Indian sadhus who took ganja and hashish on the plea of aiding their meditations. And even before he had left India, hippie tourists had become a familiar sight on the streets of Delhi. The hippies liked India because of the cultural mystic and easy access to drugs. They would meet their Indian counterparts who assured them that taking hashish was spiritual. And then they would return to America and perpetuate their misconceptions of Indian spiritual culture. It was the way of life. The local head shops carried a full line of paraphernalia. Marijuana, LSD, peyote, cocaine, and hard drugs like heroin and barbiturates were easily purchased on the streets and in the parks. Underground newspapers reported important news on the drug scene, featured a cartoon character named Captain High, and ran crossword puzzles that only a seasoned head could answer. Prabhupada had to teach that Krishna consciousness was beyond the revered LSD trip. Do you think taking LSD can produce ecstasy and higher consciousness? He once asked his storefront audience, "Then just imagine a room full of LSD. Krishna consciousness is like that." People would regularly come in and ask Swamiji's disciples, "Do you get high from this?" And the devotees would answer, "Oh yes, you can get high just by chanting. Why don't you try it?" Greg Schaff, Brahmananda's brother, hadn't tried LSD, but he wanted higher consciousness, so he decided to try the chanting. "Greg, I was 18. Everyone at the storefront had taken LSD, and I thought maybe I should too, because I wanted to feel like part of the crowd. So I asked Umapati, 'Hey Umapati, do you think I should try LSD? Because I don't know what you guys are talking about.' He said, 'No, that Swamiji said you didn't need LSD. I never did take it, so I guess it was okay.'" Hi Griva, have you ever heard of LSD? It's a psychedelic drug that comes like a pill. And if you take it, you can get religious ecstasies. Do you think this can help my spiritual life? Prabhupada, you don't need to take anything for your spiritual life. Your spiritual life is already here. Had anyone else said such a thing, Hayagriva would never have agreed with him. But because Swamiji seemed so absolutely positive, therefore there was no question of not agreeing. Satsarup, I knew Swamiji was in a state of exalted consciousness, and I was hoping that somehow he could teach the process to me. In the privacy of his room, I asked him, "Is there a spiritual advancement that you can make from which you won't fall back?" By his answer, "Yes," I was convinced that my own attempts to be spiritual on LSD, only to fall down later, could be replaced by a total spiritual life such as Swamiji had. I could see he was convinced, and then I was convinced. Greg, LSD was like the spiritual drug of the times, and Swamiji was the only one who dared to speak out against it, saying it was nonsense. I think that was the first battle he had to conquer in trying to promote his movement on the Lower East Side. Even those who came regularly to the storefront thought that LSD was good. Probably the most famous experiments with LSD in those days were by Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, Harvard psychology instructors who studied the effects of the drug, published their findings in professional journals, and advocated the use of LSD for self-realization and fulfillment. After being fired from Harvard, Timothy Leary went on to become a national priest of LSD and for some time ran an LSD commune in Millbrook, New York. When the members of the Millbrook commune heard about the Swami on the Lower East Side who led his followers in a chant that got you high, they began visiting the storefront. One night, a group of about 10 hippies from Millbrook came to Swamiji's Kirtana. They all chanted, not so much in worship of Krishna as to see what kind of high the chanting could produce. And after the lecture, a Millbrook leader asked about drugs. Prabhupada replied that drugs were not necessary for spiritual life, that they could not produce spiritual consciousness, and that all drug-induced religious visions were simply hallucinations. To realize God was not so easy or cheap that one could do it just by taking a pill or smoking. Chanting Hare Krishna, he explained, was a purifying process to uncover one's pure consciousness. Taking drugs would increase the covering and bar one from self-realization. But have you ever taken LSD? The question now became a challenge. No, Prabhupada replied, I have never taken any of these things. Not even cigarettes or tea. If you haven't taken it, then how can you say what it is? The Millbrookers looked around smiling. Two or three even burst out with laughter and they snapped their fingers, thinking the Swami had been checkmated. I have not taken, Prabhupada replied regally from his dais. But my disciples have taken all these things, marijuana, LSD, many times, and they have given them all up. You can hear from them. Hayagriva, you can speak. And Hayagriva sat up a little and spoke out in his stentorian best. Well, no matter how high you go on LSD, You eventually reach a peak and then you have to come back down. Just like traveling into outer space in a rocket ship. He gave one of Swamiji's familiar examples. Your spacecraft can travel very far away from the earth for thousands of miles, day after day. But it cannot simply go on traveling and traveling. Eventually it must land. On LSD we experience going up, but we always have to come down again. That's not spiritual consciousness. When you actually attain spiritual or Krishna consciousness, you stay high. Because you go to Krishna, you don't have to come down. You can stay high forever. Prabhupada was sitting in his back room with Hayagriva and Umapati and other disciples. The evening meeting had just ended and the visitors from Millbrook had gone. Krishna consciousness is so nice, Swamiji. Umapati spoke up. You just get higher and higher and you don't come down. Prabhupada smiled. Yes, that is right. No more coming down, Umapati said, laughing. And the others also began to laugh. Some clapped their hands, repeating, no more coming down. The conversation inspired Hayagriva and Umapati to produce a new handbill. Stay high forever, no more coming down. Practice Krishna consciousness. Expand your consciousness by practicing the transcendental sound vibration. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. The leaflet went on to extol Krishna consciousness over any other high. It included phrases like end all bring downs and turn on, and it spoke against employing artificially induced methods of self-realization and expanded consciousness. Someone objected to the flyers playing too much of the hippie mentality, but Prabhupada said it was all right. Greg, when these drug people on the Lower East Side came and talked to Swamiji, he was so patient with them. He was speaking on a philosophy which they had never heard before. When someone takes LSD, they are really into themselves and they don't hear properly when someone talks to them. So Swamiji would make particular points and they wouldn't understand him. So he would have to make the same point again. He was very patient with these people. But we are not given to their claim that LSD was a bona fide spiritual aid to self-realization. October 1966. Tompkins Square Park was the park on the Lower East Side. On the south, it was bordered by 7th Street with its 4 and 5 storied brownstone tenements. On the north side was 10th. With more brownstones, but in better condition, and the very old small building that housed the Tompkins Square branch of the New York Public Library. On Avenue B, the park's east border, stood St. Bridget's Church, built in 1848, when the neighborhood had been entirely Irish. The church, school, and rectory still occupied much of the block, and the west border of the park, Avenue A, was lined with tiny old candy stores selling newspapers, magazines, cigarettes and egg cream sodas at the counter. There were also a few bars, several grocery stores and a couple of Slavic restaurants specializing in inexpensive vegetable broths, which brought Ukrainians and hippies side by side for bodily nourishment. The park's 10 acres held many tall trees, but at least half the park was paved. A network of 5-foot-high, heavy wrought iron fences, weaved through the park, lining the walkways and protecting the grass. The fences and the many walkways and entrance to the park gave it the effect of a maze. Since the weather was still warm and it was Sunday, the park was crowded with people. Almost all the space on the benches that lined the walkways was occupied. There were old people, mostly Ukrainians, dressed in outdated suits and sweaters, even in the warm weather, sitting together in clans, talking. There were many children in the park also, mostly Puerto Ricans and blacks, but also fair-haired, hard-faced slum kids, racing around on bikes or playing with balls and frisbees. The basketball and handball courts were mostly taken by the teenagers. And as always, there were plenty of loose running dogs. a marble miniature gazebo, four pillars and a roof, with a drinking fountain inside, was a remnant from the old days, 1891, according to the inscription. On its four sides were the words hope, faith, charity and temperance. But someone had sprayed the whole structure with black paint, making crude designs and illegible names and initials. Today a bench had been taken over by several conga and bongo drummers, and the whole park pulsed with their demanding rhythms. And the hippies were there, different from the others. The bearded Bohemian men and their long-haired young girlfriends, dressed in all blue jeans, were still an unusual sight. Even in the Lower East Side melting pot, their presence created tension. They were from middle-class families, and so they had not been driven to the slums by dire economic necessity. This created conflicts in their dealings with the underprivileged immigrants, and the hippies' well-known proclivity for psychedelic drugs, their revolt against their families and affluence, and their absorption in the avant-garde sometimes made them the jeered minority among their neighbors. But the hippies just wanted to do their own thing and created their own revolution for love and peace. So usually they were tolerated, although not appreciated. There were various groups among the young and hip at Tompkins Square Park. There were friends who had gone to the same school together, who took the same drug together, or who agreed on a particular philosophy of art, literature, politics or metaphysics. There were lovers, there were groups hanging out together for reasons undecipherable, except for the common purpose of doing their own thing. And there were others who lived like hermits. A loner would sit on a park bench, analyzing the effects of cocaine, looking up at the strangely rustling green leaves of the trees and the blue sky above the tenements, and then down to the garbage at his feet, as he helplessly followed his mind from fear to illumination, to disgust, to hallucination, on and on. Until after a few hours, the drug began to wear off and he was again a common stranger. Sometimes they would sit up all night, spaced out in the park, until at last, in the light of morning, they would stretch out on benches to sleep. Hippies especially took to the park on Sundays. They at least passed through the park on their way to St. Mark's Place, Greenwich Village, or the Lexington Avenue subway at Astor Place, or the IND subway at Houston and 2nd, or to catch an uptown bus on 1st Avenue, a downtown bus on 2nd, or a crosstown on 9th. Or they went to the park just to get out of their apartments and sit together in the open air, to get high again, to talk, or to walk through the park's maze of pathways. But whatever the hippies' diverse interests and drives, the Lower East Side was an essential part of the mystique. It was not just a dirty slum. It was the best place in the world to conduct the experiment in consciousness. For all its filth and threat of violence and the confined life of its brownstone tenements, the Lower East Side was still the forefront of the revolution in mind expansion. Unless you were living there and taking psychedelics or marijuana, or at least intellectually pursuing the quest for free personal religion, you weren't enlightened, and you weren't taking part in the most progressive evolution of human consciousness. And it was this searching, a quest beyond the humdrum existence of the ordinary materialistic straight American, that brought unity to the otherwise eclectic gathering of hippies on the Lower East Side. Into this chaotic pageant, Swamiji entered with his followers and sat down to hold a kirtana. Three or four devotees who arrived ahead of him selected an open area of the park, put out the oriental carpet Robert Nelson had donated, sat down on it and began playing kartals and chanting Hare Krishna. Immediately some boys rode up on their bicycles break just short of the carpet and stood astride their bikes, curiously and irreverently staring. Other passers-by gathered to listen. Meanwhile, Swamiji, accompanied by a half dozen disciples, was walking the 8 blocks from the storefront. Brahmananda carried the harmonium and the Swami's drum. Ketanananda, who was now shaven-headed at Swamiji's request and dressed in loose-flowing canary yellow robes, created an extra sensation. Drivers pulled their cars over to have a look, their passengers leaning forward, agape at the outrageous dress and shaved head. As the group passed a store, people inside would poke each other and indicate the spectacle. People came to the windows of their tenements, taking in the Swami and his group as if a parade were passing. The Puerto Rican tough guys especially couldn't restrain themselves from exaggerated reactions. "Hey Buddha," they taunted. "Hey, you forgot to change your pajamas." They made shrill screams as if imitating Indian war whoops they had heard in Hollywood westerns. "Hey, Arabs," exclaimed one heckler, who began imitating what he thought was an Eastern dance. No one on the street knew anything about Krishna consciousness, nor even of Hindu culture and customs. To them, the Swami's entourage was just a bunch of crazy hippies showing off. But they didn't quite know what to make of the Swami. He was different. Nevertheless, they were suspicious. Some, however, like Irving Halpern, a veteran Lower East Side resident, felt sympathetic towards his towards this stranger, who was apparently a very dignified person on a peaceful mission. Irving Halpern. A lot of people had spectacularized notions of what a Swami was, as though they were going to suddenly see people lying on the little mattresses made out of nails, and all kinds of other absurd notions. Yet here came just a very graceful, peaceful, gentle, obviously well-meaning being into a lot of hostility. Hippies? What are they? Communists? While the young taunted, the middle-aged and elderly shook their heads or stared, cold and uncomprehending. The way to the park was spotted with blasphemies, ribald jokes and tension, but no violence. After the successful Kirtana in Washington Square Park, Prabhupada had been regularly sending out parades of 3 or 4 devotees chanting and playing hand cymbals through the streets and sidewalks of the Lower East Side. On one occasion, they had been bombarded with water balloons and eggs, and they were sometimes faced with bullies looking for a fight, but they were never attacked, just stared at, laughed at, or shouted at. Today the ethnic neighbors just assumed that Prabhupada and his followers had come onto the streets dressed in outlandish costumes as a joke, just to turn everything topsy-turvy and cause stares and howls. They felt that their responses were only natural for any normal, respectable American slum dweller. So it was quite an adventure before the group even reached the park. Still, Swamiji, however, remained unaffected. "What are they saying?" he asked once or twice, and Brahmananda explained. Prabhupada had a way of holding his head high, his chins up as he walked forward. It made him look aristocratic and determined. His vision was spiritual. He saw everyone as a spiritual spiritual soul, and Krishna as the controller of everything. And aside from that, even from a worldly point of view, he was unafraid of the city's pandemonium. After all, he was an experienced Calcutta man. The Kirtana had been going for about 10 minutes when Swamiji arrived, stepping out of his white rubber slippers, just as if he were home in the temple. He sat down on the rug with his followers, who had now stopped their singing and were watching him. He wore a pink sweater and around his shoulders a khadi wrapper. He smiled. Looking at his group, he indicated the rhythm by counting 1, 2, 3. Then he began clapping his hands heavily as he continues counting 1, 2, 3. The Kartalas followed, at first with wrong beats, but he kept the rhythm by clapping his hands. And then they got it, clapping hands, clashing cymbals artlessly to a slow, steady beat. He began singing prayers that no one else knew. Vandeham Sri Guroho Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha. His voice was sweet like the harmonium, rich in the nuances of Bengali melody. Sitting on the rug under a large oak tree, he sang the mysterious Sanskrit prayers. None of his followers knew any mantras but Hare Krishna. But they knew Swamiji. And they kept the rhythm, listening closely to him. While the trucks rumbled on the street and the conga drums pulsed in the distance. As he sang, Sri Rupam Sagrajadam, the dogs came by. Kids stared, a few mockers pointed fingers. Hey, who is that priest, man? But his voice was a shelter beyond the clashing dualities. His voice went on ringing cymbals while he sang alone. Sri Radha Krishna Padan. Prabhupada sang prayers in praise of the pure conjugal love for Krishna of Srimati Radharani, the beloved of the gopis. Each word passed down for hundreds of years by the intimate associates of Krishna was saturated with a deep and transcendental meaning that only he understood. Sagana Lalita Sri Vishakanitamscha. They waited for him to begin Hare Krishna, although hearing him chant was exciting enough. More people came, which was what Prabhupada wanted. He wanted them chanting and dancing with him, and now his followers wanted that too. They wanted to be with him. They had tried together at the UN, Ananda Ashram and Washington Square. It seemed that this would be the thing they would always do. Go with Swamiji and sit and chant. He would always be with them chanting. Then he began the mantra. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. They responded, too low and muddled at first, but he returned it to them again, singing it right and triumphant. Again they responded, gaining heart, ringing kartals and clapping hands. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Again he sang it alone and they stayed, hanging on closely on each word, clapping, beating cymbals and watching him looking back at them from his inner concentration. His age-old wisdom, his bhakti and out of love for Swamiji. And out of love for Swamiji, they broke loose from their surroundings and joined him as a chanting congregation. Swamiji played a small drum, holding it strapped to his left hand, bracing the drum against his body and with his right hand playing intricate mridanga rhythms. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. He was going strong after half an hour. Repeating the mantra, carrying them with him as interested onlookers gathered in greater numbers. A few hippies sat down on the edge of the rug, copying the cross-legged sitting posture, listening, clapping, trying the chanting, and the small inner circle of Prabhupada and his followers grew as gradually more people joined. As always, his kirtana attracted musicians. Irving Halpern. I make flutes and I play musical instruments. There are all kinds of different instruments that I make. When the Swami came, I went up and started playing and he welcomed me. Whenever a new musician would join and play their first note, he would extend his arms. It would be as though he had stepped up to the podium and was going to lead the New York New York Philharmonic. I mean, there was this gesture that every musician knows. You just know when someone else wants you to play with them and feels good that you are playing with them. And this very basic kind of musician communication was there with him, and I related to it very quickly, and I was happy about it. Lawn musicians were always loitering in different parts of the park, and when they heard they could play with the Swami's chanting and that they were welcome, then they began to come by one by one. A saxophone player came just because there was such a strong rhythm section to play with. Others, like Irving Halpern, saw it as something spiritual, with good vibrations. As the musicians joined, more passers-by were drawn into the kirtana. Prabhupada had been singing both lead and chorus, and many who had joined now sang the lead part also, so that there was a constant chorus of chanting. During the afternoon, the crowd grew to more than 100, with a dozen musicians trying with their congo and bongo drums, bamboo flutes, metal flutes, mouth organs, wooden metal clackers, tambourines and guitars to stay with the Swami. Irving Halpern, the part resounded. The musicians were very careful in listening to the mantra. When Swami sang Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare, there was sometimes a Krishna, a tripling of what had been a double syllable. It would be usually on the first stanza, and the musicians really picked up on it. The Swami would pronounce it in a particular way, and the musicians were really meticulous and listened very carefully to the way the Swami would sing. And we began to notice that there were different melodies for the same brief sentence, and we got to count on that one regularity. Like one would count on the conductor of an orchestra or the lead singer of a Mardi Gras. It was really pleasant, and people would dig one another in their ribs. They would say, "Hey, see," we would catch and repeat a particular subtle pronunciation of a Sanskrit phrase that the audience, in their enthusiasm, while they would be dancing or playing, had perhaps missed. Or the Swami would add an extra beat, but it meant something, in the way in which the drummer, who at that time was the Swami, the main drummer, would hit the drums. I have talked to a couple of musicians about it, and we agreed that in his head, the Swami must have had hundreds and hundreds of melodies that had been brought back from the real learning from the other side of the world. So many people came there just to tune into the musical gift, the transmission of the Dharma. "Hey," they would say, "listen to this holy monk." People were really sure there were going to be unusual feats, grandstanding, flashy levitation, or whatever people expected was going to happen. But when the simplicity of what the Swami was really saying, when you began to sense it, whether you were motivated to actually make a lifetime commitment and go this way of life, or whether you merely wanted to appreciate it and place it in a place and give certain due respect to it, it turned you around. And that was interesting too, the different ways in which people regarded the kirtana. Some people thought it was a prelude. Some people thought it was a main event. Some people liked the music. Some people liked the poetic sound of it. Then Allen Ginsberg and Peter Orlowski arrived, along with some of their friends. Allen surveyed the scene and found a seat among the chanters. With his black beard, his eyeglasses, his bald spot surrounded by long black ringlets of hair, Allen Ginsberg, the poet patriarch, come to join the chanting, greatly enhanced the local prestige of the kirtana. Prabhupada, while continuing his ecstatic chanting and drum playing, acknowledged Allen and smiled. A reporter from the New York Times dropped by and asked Allen for an interview, but he refused. "A man should not be disturbed while worshipping. The Times would have to wait." Allen: "Tompkins Square Park was a hotbed of spiritual conflict in those days, so it was absolutely great. All of a sudden, in the midst of all the talk and drugs and theory, for some people to put their bodies, their singing, to break through the intellectual ice and come out with total bhakti, that was really amazing." The blacks and Puerto Ricans were out there with drums too, doing conga. But here was a totally different kind of group, some of them with shaven heads, and it was interesting. It was a repetitious chant, but that was also great. It was an easy chant to get into. It was an open scene. There was no box corner there in the actual practice. So general smiles and approval and encouragement as a beginning of some kind of real communal get-together in the park with a kind of serious underbase for exchange instead of just hog-dog on the drums. Prabhupada was striking to see. His brow was furrowed in the effort of singing loud and his visage was strong. The veins in his temples stood out visibly and his jaw jutted forward as he sang his Hare Krishna for all to hear. Although his demeanor was pleasant, his chanting was intensive, sometimes straining, and everything about him was concentration. It was in someone else's yoga retreat or silent peace vigil, but a pure chanting BN of Prabhupada's own doing. It was a new wave, something everyone could take part in. The community seemed to be accepting it. It became so popular that the ice cream vendor came over to make sales. Beside Prabhupada, a group of young, blonde-haired boys, 5 or 6 years old, were just sitting around. A young polished boy stood staring. Someone began burning frankincense on a glowing coal in a metal strainer, and the sweet fumes billowed among the flutists, drummers, and chanters. So we'll stop there. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Shri Shri Gauranitai ki jai. Shri Shri Radharam Swiyaji ki jai. Shri Shri Siddharam Lakshmana Bhaktan Mahan ki jai. Lord Varaha Dev appearance name also ki jai.